Paradise Radio for the Seeker.
Welcome back, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to Red Ice Radio. This is Henrik, and we are coming to you from Sweden. Wherever you are, you can follow us worldwide at redicecreations.com. Adrian Salbucci is known for speaking and writing about geopolitics, international relations, political power structures, and also financial globalization. His latest book is called The Coming World Government. Adrian regularly writes and shows up on RT. He is the founder of the Argentine Second Republic Project and is also an international business consultant. He is with us today to give us an update on how the development of world government is transpiring from the viewpoint of South America. Hi, Adrian. Welcome back. And thank you for coming on once again. Good talking to you.
My pleasure, Henrik. How are you?
I am doing pretty good, actually. It's been an interesting week here so far. A lot of developments, of course. Since we last spoke, Adrian, there have been a lot of things I'd like to ask you about, specifically from your position in Latin America, South America. But the big news, the biggest news, I guess, you know, to me anyway, must be the selection of the Argentinian Jesuit Pope earlier this year. Did this come as a big surprise to you, Adrian, or did you kind of have your eye on this for some time before this unfolded?
Well, it came as a surprise to just about everybody down here because nobody expected to actually have an Argentine Monsignor become a pope, especially the way that Benedict XVI just resigned instead of dying as popes normally do. He resigned in February. But in a way, there was a lot of comment when Benedict XVI was chosen as pope that there had been that Jorge Bergoglio, the Archbishop of Buenos Aires, his name had sounded rather repeatedly. So although people were surprised in a pleasant manner because nobody thought it would actually be him itself, it did not really come as any major surprise because he was one of the people who were earmarked in a way to become the next pope.
What do you make of him being a Jesuit? That's kind of significant. I mean, it's the first one, as far as I know, who's openly calling themselves a Jesuit. So what's going on here?
Well, we all know that the Jesuits, often we wonder whether the Jesuits are subordinated to the church or if the church is subordinated to the Jesuits. That's a long, ongoing discussion on that subject for many, many decades, even centuries.
Yeah.
The fact that he is a Jesuit is important. The fact that he is a man of a vast intellectual culture, undoubtedly, as most people at that level in the Vatican are, will give you an idea that probably there will be a change. I don't know if for better or for worse, but there will be a change at the Vatican. Some of the measures are being seen because the Jesuits have always been harping on the fact that the finance in the Vatican has to be overseen much closer. All these perversion problems that they've had with child molesting and things like that, well, yeah, that obviously will hopefully start changing. But as I say, that you never quite know what a Jesuit is thinking. You never quite know what he is planning, and they definitely do have a very strategic mindset when it comes to various problems that affect the church in particular and the world as a whole. They have a very stormy history, even down here in Latin America, where they were suppressed by the church, suppressed by local governments in the 16th and 17th and even 18th centuries. But let me put it this way, they've done surprisingly well, and they are quite highly respected here.
What do you think of the reasons behind Ratzinger's or Pope Benedict XVI's, resignation? Is this, due to the position the church has been in, as you alluded to, with child molestation and everything, and maybe Pope Francis here coming in, then maybe he's slated to kind of try to clean up the church a bit and try to get a better reputation going. What do you think is going on kind of behind the scenes here?
That might be. That seems to be the one of the indications, because the problem with Joseph Ratzinger was facing, I think, is that his frail health, because of the fact that he is over, he's something like 85 or 84, I think it is, which obviously probably exceeds his energy. I think that he was wise enough to understand that the cleanup process inside the Vatican is so vast, is so complex, that it probably surpassed his frail health, not his intellectual capability, but maybe definitely his health, and very likely also his willpower. Mr. Bergoglio is younger than Pope Benedict, and he is also he's known to be very strong-willed, and he speaks very openly and very clearly, and he is also very strategic-minded. I'll just give you an example. We have a very left-wing, ideological scene, government here of Mrs. Kirchner, and before her husband. Yep. And they've been in power for almost 10 years. And, for example, in the last 3 years, Mr. Bergoglio had requested an audience from Mrs. Kirchner for...
All right, so Adrian, we're switching over to a phone here because we had some issues with Skype. But just before you would cut off here, you were talking about Christina Kirchner and basically the Pope, or before he was the Pope, kind of demanding an audience, if you will, with her. And I've heard as well that there's been tensions between these two for some time. Tell us more about that.
Well, absolutely, because when Francis was the Archbishop of Buenos Aires until this year, he obviously had a very difficult relationship with the Kirchners, who are left of center, but very, shall we say, irrational in the way that they handle many things. It's not just a problem with the Archbishop of Buenos Aires. They've had problems not just with the church, but with the armed forces, with bordering countries. They seem to pick a fight with just about everybody, and obviously that included Mr. Bergoglio, the present Pope. And he had requested 14 times in the past 2.5 years, almost 3 years, an audience with Mrs. Kirchner, and she never once even answered. Now, the Buenos Aires Cathedral is only about 40 meters away from the presidential palace, so it wasn't really something that was logistically difficult to set up. She just ignored him. Yeah. However, when he was chosen Pope, the first head of state that he invited officially to visit him at the Vatican was Mrs. Kirchner. In a way, that was his way of giving her a lesson, so to speak, to explain to how these things should be handled. I mention this because he's very open minded. He's very he voices his ideas very openly. So when he agrees with something, he will say so very openly and stick to his guns. And when he is against something, he will also very much stick to his guns. So one may expect that he will be a very forceful a leader within the Vatican.
I want to talk more about Kirchner and what's going on in Argentina with this. You've written some really good articles on this in terms of the K corruption list, etc. We'll get to that, but I want to just remain a little bit on this note in terms of why he named himself Pope Francis, kind of alluding to the Franciscan order, kind of having, he's talked a lot about, you know, the poverty and you know, fighting poverty and everything else that the church, you know, continuously are doing as a propaganda scheme, of course, while they're sitting on some of the most amassed wealth on the planet. But you'd think then that he and Kirchner maybe would agree if they're more on the left, if I can put it that way. What do you make of that?
Well, yeah, I think that we all, the fact that he does not have an ideological agreement and that they don't see eye to eye with the present left-wing government of Argentina does not mean that he is right-wing. If anything, Mr. Bergoglio is anything but right-wing, even though some people have tried to make him appear as such. So he is definitely fighting the excessive show of wealth within the Vatican. He has clearly said that he does not like to see the upper hierarchies of the church going around in very fancy and expensive cars. He himself has not taken up the official residence of the Pope, which is extremely luxurious, and has chosen something much more. He's played down that part very much so, just as he has already intervened in the Vatican Bank, the Institute of Religious Operations. So in a way, we can tell that he definitely has a more realistic outlook on that. And the fact that he chose the name of Francis, I think, points to the fact that St. Francis is one of his most admired saints in the church. And his we all know that the example that St. Francis gave was of more poverty, less show of extreme wealth. So I think that he does that in a genuine manner, the problem with the Kirchners is that the fact that they say a lot of things that sound left-wing, and their statements and their official speeches are very much that they are with the people and with the poor people and so forth. However, that is very much hypocrisy-ridden.
Sure.
Because when you look at the actions that the government actually takes, well, the terrible corruption charges of the last couple of months show that, if anything, they're just giving some little breadcrumbs to the very poor here, and they're taking all the huge tons of money in what is the worst corruption case in the history of this country, maybe even the history of this region.
Well, that's right. It's a lot of rhetoric, and a lot of left-wing people are falling for it. They're falling for the words rather than the action, of course. And Christina Kirchner has gotten into a second term. But before we talk about that, how do you think the Catholic Church and the Vatican then will develop here in the next years to come? A difficult question to answer. But is he going to manage clean things up, or are we just kind of watching the slow demise of the whole institution right now?
Well, I think that, and here we're really getting into very stormy waters. I think he will continue trying, because looking at his track record, I really believe what I'm about to say, that he will continue trying to clean things up. The question is, A, will he be able to do so? Will he be able to really have such authority that he will be able to impose his will on the entire clergy in the Vatican and elsewhere? And B, will somebody decide to solve the problem as happened with John Paul I? Will he be able to survive? Because we have to be very pragmatic in this. Unfortunately, examples of murder in the church are not something new. In the 20th century, so it was probably one of the worst cases with the extremely short 33-day reign of Pope John Paul I, who also wanted to clean up the Vatican Bank, and well, he obviously was not able to do so. So the question is, will Francis actually survive?
Well, exactly. It's a good question. We'll have to see what happens with that. Now, going back to Kirchner again here, she was reelected in 2011, and in one of your recent articles, you wrote the following: a year and a half into Kristina's second term, Argentina is once again rollercoasting increasingly out of control into what may yet become another national catastrophe, marked by spiraling inflation, a panic-driven foreign exchange clampdown, economic slump, increasing street violence, ferocious taxation of workers, failing salaries, and worst of all, rampant, unprecedented corruption at the highest levels of government. So tell us more about this, you know, the corruption within her government, basically, and what you know about this.
Well, absolutely, and if anything, it all started even before Néstor Kirchner became president almost exactly 10 years ago. He was inaugurated president in May 2003, but before that, he was for 10 years the governor of Santa Cruz province, which is one of the provinces way down south. I have to mention this openly from the very beginning. I'm one of the two people who actually filed a legal suit against Néstor Kirchner almost 9 years ago, actually, because he had received $654 million of federal funds because he followed up on the privatization of the state oil company YPF when President Carlos Menem was in power. And those $653 million that the province received in 1993, Néstor Kirchner took them out of the country, expatriated them, and they've never been heard from again. Now, we do know, because extensive investigations have been made, that a sizable chunk of that ended up in the private banking section of Credit Suisse and the Union Bank of Switzerland. So the key question here is, not to go into too much detail, is what are public funds of the state of the province of Santa Cruz doing deposited in the private banking area of two major Swiss banks, which are also tax havens? Now, they have such power over the local Justice Department and judiciary that they were able to get the judges to exonerate them and say that there's no crimes were committed, etc. But in the specific case of the lawsuit that we filed, the judge that actually exonerated them happens to be his son-in-law. So as you can see, justice is not exactly independent in this country. I think the best way to explain the Kirchners, and probably many other governments in different parts of the world, and certainly in South America, for example, in Brazil, even in Chile before President Pineda, is to say that they are all basically social democratic, but in the modern sense of the world, In a way, with the present power structures and on planet Earth, use international social democracy as a way of promoting a new ideology for globalization, for world government. And it has basically three parts. Let me just quickly mention this, because I think it helps to understand the issue.
Yeah, please do.
On the cultural and social side, they are all very much left-wing. In Argentina, they are against the church, against the armed forces, pro-gay marriage, pro-abortion, are very much against traditions and so forth, which buys the will of a lot of the poorer people. On the political scene, they are very center. They will respect the ongoing global power structures, absolutely, which is something that the Kirchners have always done. And then on the economic and financial front, they are all very liberal right-wing. They just keep signing and paying all that the bankers are requiring of them. And the Kirchners, incredibly, have been one of the governments of Argentina that has most paid international bankers for Argentina's public debt, which could be easily, and I really mean this, could be very easily rejected, because most of Argentina's public debt dates back to the illegal military regime from 1976 to 1983. So if anything, they were able to access power here 10 years ago, Mr. Néstor Kirchner, because they basically told the bankers that whatever happened, they would never investigate the origin of Argentina's public debt. So in a way, we have that threefold way of governing, so to speak. They win the popularity in the masses by having a rather light left-wing ideological outlook. They win the willpower, the will and the support of the global power elite by respecting that power elite. And they obviously, they just keep paying and paying. They give priority to paying public debt over the needs of the people.
It's a merging of all the different systems that we've had, and the result, of course, is that everyone is being robbed at the end of it. It's a compromise to make everyone happy, and politically, this is, I think, I mean, because the same has happened in Sweden, identically. I mean, it's like, you know, super high taxes, for example, while at the same time everything is being privatized, and you have this upper clique of an elite that are beneficial on this. But on the, you know, as you say, on the cultural social side, it's socialism, if you will, or democratic socialism for everyone else. But the end of the bottom line is that this is depleting everybody on that level, unfortunately, those who fall for the rhetoric of all this.
Well, yeah, you know, in a way, when the global power elite decided that they were going to move on from globalization, which they're basically wrapping up now after almost 22 years, or 23 years, actually, of having introduced globalization with the fall of the Berlin Wall, now they're moving on to world government, and they do need to have some sort of ideological system that will support world government, that will keep, they try to keep the people more or less at bay. They keep their financial prowess and the financial advantage permanently, and they migrate power structures as they best feel. So in a way, social democracy, modern social democracy, not traditional, but modern social democracy, the third way, as Anthony Giddens from the London School of Economics has defined,
yeah,
works really very well as a transitional system until they can get their act right and actually introduce formal world government, which is probably still a couple of decades down the road. And the Kirchners have been a perfect example of that, because they have been able to coax the people, especially the lower classes, or I wouldn't say the lower class, I would say the less politically cultured classes, into supporting them. And the system works so well that the opposition is almost non-existent. And that is not the fault of the Kirchners, but it's the fault of a very flabby opposition that we have here, that have no new ideas, they have no new solutions, they will not tackle the fundamental problems, like, for example, thoroughly investigating Argentina's public debt, which could be very easily done, because, as I say, it dates back started being generated by an illegal government that ousted the democratically elected government in 1976. And we could easily say, hey, bankers, didn't you guys know that these guys were repressing everybody, that they made 30,000 people disappear, that they had clandestine jails, that we had the dirty war? When you guys were loaning them billions of dollars, didn't you realize that? And they could, if you look at the principle of odious debt, which dates back from the beginning of the 20th century, Argentina's public debt could easily be classified as odious debt. And yet the system works so well that this December of 2013, it's going to be 30 years since Argentina went back to democracy, and yet not one single president in the last 30 years ever even dared to say, I'm going to investigate the origin of Argentina's public debt. No, they all just say, we're going to pay and pay and pay. And it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and the people get more and more impoverished.
Yeah. Yeah, it's unbelievable. I mean, you wrote that Argentina is a money laundering haven. I mean, massive amounts of wealth is being taken out from the country. You even have in your article about the scandal where they're basically, the Kirchner has some fetish with the, 500 euro notes and whatever, and bags of money is being shipped out and it's being laundered through Argentina. Tell us more about that.
Well, that's been very much in the news in the last 3 months, basically, because the Kirchners, amongst the people that they really picked horrendous fights with, is with the largest local multimedia empire, which is called Clarín. That's C-L-A-R-I-N. Clarín is a newspaper, it's a TV channel, it's a cable system. They have a lot of multimedia and so forth, so they're very powerful. And they started out being Kirchnerites back in 2003, and then probably for money matters, they changed their mind. Now, Clarín is very pro-U.S., it's very pro-global power elite. 18% of the sharehold of Clarín is Goldman Sachs, so that'll give you an idea of the kind of people we're talking about. So it's a bit of a fight between amongst mafia families. And what happened is that they have a very, very good investigation department, and their spokesman, or the man who has become their spokesman in the last 3 months, is a relatively well-known journalist by the name of Jorge Lanata. And they really made a very thorough investigation showing how Néstor Kirchner's henchmen, so to speak, would steal so much money, and Mr. Kirchner had such a passion for cash, not bank accounts, but real cash, with 500 euro banknotes being his favorite, that one of the guys that he was able to actually interview and put on his program said that there was so much money laundering that instead of counting the money and putting it into bags, they would actually weigh the money because that went faster. So they would say, here are 20 kilos of 500 euro notes. How much is it? Well, I don't know. We don't have time to count it, so to speak. Now, there's been practically the entire government is under accusation for money laundering and for corruption, starting with Mr. Kirchner, who unfortunately, from this point of view, died in 2010, so there's not much you can do to bring him to justice, but it includes his wife, it includes the Vice President, Amado Boudou, and it includes all the main ministers. Now, Mrs. Kirchner is on record that her official declaration with the tax office in 2003 showed that she had a personal wealth of around 7 million pesos, which was about, I don't know, $3.5 million, which is already a lot of money. And yet, in 2011, she declared that she had 70 million pesos. And when she was in Harvard University last year, a young girl asked her, well, how did you manage to increase your own personal wealth 10 times in the last 10 years. And she said, I've been a very successful lawyer. Now, there's even a doubt whether she is a registered lawyer, period. There's not one single case in any Argentine court where one can verify that she was even given important fees or that she won a large fee that would justify such wealth. So the problem that the Argentinians now have is that with all the proof of all these corruption cases, the government just says nothing and keeps going on and going on as though nothing happened. So, yes, we do have a very serious corruption case. Probably this will come to a head at some point in the next month, especially now that there are going to be elections. But it's very tough because these people are very good at outright lying. Outright lying in the sense that when you're confronted with a serious accusation, even personal serious accusations, like, you and your son and your ministers and the vice president are all corrupt and here are our proofs, and they come out and say nothing, in a way you say, well, either, that it's part of a strategy, obviously it is, or if you don't defend yourself, in a way you're admitting that that is true. Now, they still have such control over the official media and over a large sector of the poorer people who won't even be able to understand what's happening, that they still continue in power, and they probably will continue for a while yet to come.
Well, they seem to have their little dynasty going here, and nepotism as a, you know, at its finest, basically. But where will this go then, Adrian, if developments continue as they do? Is the country heading for, you know, another economic depression, recession? What do you think?
Well, yes, it probably we will have another serious problem. Look, I'm 60 years old, and in my 60 years, I've gone through 4 economic collapses, 3 military coups, and something like, I don't know, a lost international war. In Argentina, things happen fast.
Yeah.
So I would say that probably we're in for another major collapse economically, because they have not been able to curb inflation, and it's gotten so bad, and they are so functional to the banks that they need to get their hands on every single dollar that is going around in Argentina, so that they can pay Argentina's foreign debt to the bankers. And that's why the bankers are keeping very quiet about all the economic problems and all the economic woes in this country. Right now, it is impossible for any individual in Argentina to obtain dollars or euros or even the currency of bordering countries to travel abroad, because the government has put a complete clampdown on buying foreign currency. Now, in a way, when nobody's asking the obvious question, why do they need all these dollars? Well, basically because the balance of trade has turned around. Government spending has gone up very, very much so, and they just can't get their hands on the sufficient number of dollars that bankers are demanding in order to pay for Argentina's foreign debt. So when confronted with heeding to the interest of the mega bankers or heeding to the interest of the people in health, security, and all the other, and education, they will always choose the bankers. A prime example of this, Henrik, is that in 2006, in January 2006, then President Nestor Kirchner paid the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, the full debt Argentina had with the IMF of $10 billion in cash, with no reduction whatsoever, in U.S. dollars, in exchange for nothing. Now, that was a lot of money. So, in a way, it was a demand from the IMF. Instead of putting all that money to work for health, education, et cetera, they prefer to give it to the IMF. And they're doing that constantly, year after year, very quietly. And that's where big media like Clarín will also shut their mouths, because if Clarín were to say, look at the Kirchners, they are favoring the interests of the bankers instead of the people, well, you can imagine that their main shareholder, Goldman Sachs, wouldn't be too happy with that.
Yeah, that's right. So these cyclical collapses that has happened in other countries as well, but I think more frequently in Argentina, as you describe it, but these lead to reformation of the economic system. And more and more, this, you know, what the result is here is that, you know, control is gained when loans are granted, you know, by World Banks, IMF, etc., austerity measures. And that is the plan. And this is happening in other countries as well. But this is a path towards stronger World Bank system, basically, where the individual nations no longer will be able to, you know, stand on their own legs, so to speak. They become dependent and completely riddled with debt. And this is what's happening in Argentina as well, correct?
Well, you know, this basically the global power elite, and we have to be very careful about how we define them. We can't really identify them with any specific country. They are above all countries. They are absolutely supranational. They have no flag of their own, so to speak. They are embedded in different countries. Probably the country they are most embedded in is the United States and the UK, because that's from where power emanates.
Yeah.
But it's not American power. It's not British power. It's global power, master power.
That's right.
Which has a lot to do with the banking system and the media system and all the money sloshing going backwards and forwards all over the place. Now, their preferred way or method of controlling entire countries and eroding their sovereignty is through finance, although every now and then they will choose military invasion, which is much more direct and much more obvious when you watch it on the 6 o'clock news. Take Libya, take Iraq, take Syria. They would love to invade Iran, obviously, but, you know, that's rather old-fashioned, and they have to be very careful how they do that, because then there are other factors to be reckoned with, like the Russians and the Chinese. But when it comes to when they can control an entire country financially, as they do Argentina, and as they do many, many, many other countries, it's more subtle, it's easier, and their preferred political system under that scheme is what they call democracy, which is no democracy whatsoever, because basically what they do, at least in this country, is they choose the politicians and the political parties that are willing to do their dirty work against the country and in their favor, for example, continue paying our public debt decade after decade after decade, even though it balloons permanently, and they actually help to balloon it, as long as they keep the people at bay. And keeping the people at bay often is much cheaper than not paying the bankers. So in a way, our whole political system, all the candidates are basically people who have been vetted for one reason or another, whether from the right or from the left or from the center, by the global power elite. And that's where the major media are part of the problem, because you have, we call it here a triangular problem. First side of the triangle is whatever government is in power. Right now in Argentina, it's the Kirchners. Second side of the triangle is the so-called opposition parties, who will criticize everything about government except for the key issues, for example, finance. And the third side of that triangle are the mainstream media, who will only allow politicians that they want to be heard nationwide. So if there's anybody somewhere else with a different idea, well, 40 million Argentinians will never hear about that. So the merry-go-round just keeps going and going and going. That's the problem in Argentina, that although the ongoing government is very, very bad, there's nothing really in the opposition that will inspire you to say, hey, now here's somebody who might change things around, because they are all having their voices heard throughout the country and even outside the country, because the mainstream media decide to put them on camera and to show them on television and in the newspapers. And the mainstream media, as I say, Clarín has 18% of Goldman Sachs, and the second largest newspaper here, it's a multimedia outlet called La Nación, The Nation, they have Citicorp as one of their main shareholders. Yeah. Aside from the fact that all newspapers and TV channels live from their advertising, and advertising here with all the main multinational companies.
Yeah, well, it's as bad as here. Here we have a government-subsidized media. There we have corporate-subsidized media. I mean, we have that, you know, the corporate-subsidized media here as well. So it's a double whammy here. But I wanted to ask you more about a potential, Latin American spring. You wrote about this recently as well, kind of as things extend out into other countries, specifically Brazil. Some stuff has been happening and developing lately. And you write like this: like a bolt out of the blue, the streets of Brazil, major cities are being rocked by widespread demonstrations. Some turning quite ugly. And you question, basically, are these all spontaneous, or is it something lurking in the background? Tell us why you have that line of questioning in there, why you're suspicious that something else might be going on here.
Well, first of all, I think we have to understand what the whole spring, quote-unquote, phenomenon was and is really all about, and it obviously started with the Arab Spring. I personally don't think that there is any such thing as an Arab Spring, the way it's being shown by the media, but it's merely a new way of global warfare coming from the global power elite. Let me explain that a little bit. They are engineering social convulsions, escalating them up to civil war, as we saw in Libya and as we are seeing in Syria. And the really tough and tricky part is that they normally use genuine complaints from the people. I mean, when the people started taking over the squares and streets of Egypt and of Libya and even of Syria, there are many, many, not all, but many genuine grievances. I mean, there are people who are saying, you know, Mubarak is no good. Now there are people saying Morsi is no good. There are people who would say Gaddafi has stayed on for too long. And normally they are genuine grievances. And you can tell that they are engineered, because they know that in the Arab world, the main divide is religious. It's the Shiites against the Sunnis. It's both Muslim confessions against Israel and the state of Israel and Zionism. So that they know that all they have to do is use those divides to stir up a lot of trouble. Now, they've learned a lot over the past 3 years from the so-called Arab Spring, and they've been able to either destroy entire countries as Libya, or throw them into civil war as Syria, or try to really outflank them as in Iran, or just erode their power. Egypt was a very powerful country, had a real big say in the region, and now its national sovereignty and its power has been severely eroded because of all the internal strife. Now, I believe that they're bringing that over to Latin America. Now, in Latin America, the conditions are very different. you cannot generate social strife, civil commotions by through taking advantage of religious divides. There's just no way that that can happen here because religion is not such a key issue. The great divide here, contrary to the Muslim world, the one that really has a lot of social significance and social sensitivity, is the extremely rich against the extremely poor.
Right.
Now, Brazil is a good example of that, and they are there are very genuine grievances there, not just the hike in public transport, but there are genuine grievances regarding corruption, very similar to Argentina. Corruption, excessive spending. Brazil is going to host the World Cup, the Football World Cup next year, and then the Olympics in 2016, and people are saying, why don't we put all that money into health, education, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Now, they're going to do that in Argentina. I think that we have to be very careful because the very same divide exists here. But in Brazil, contrary to Argentina, Brazil has become too strong for global power elite peace of mind, so to speak. Don't forget that Brazil is part of BRICS, together with Russia, India, and China, also South Africa. But they're trying to separate Brazil from Russia, India, and China, that literally and geographically lie shoulder to shoulder in Asia, in Eurasia, actually.
Mm.
So Brazil has become too strong, and they are you can tell that they are isolating Brazil from its other BRIC partners. And that's why all this social strife is being stirred, and that is definitely debilitating and weakening the country. Just take a look at the map. The United States reactivated its fourth South Atlantic Fleet in 2008. Baby Bush did that. Now, the fourth South Atlantic Fleet had been created in 1941 during World War II and fully deactivated in 1953. In comes George W., and he decides to reactivate it, and believe me, it's very powerful. Its main base is in Tampa, Florida, in 2008. And at the same time, the Brits have, throughout the last three decades, they've really made the Falkland, Malvinas Islands into a nuclear military base, very, very powerful. And it's not geared against Argentina, in spite of all the big, all the headlines on the newspaper, because Argentina has completely disarmed itself. We are completely vulnerable. We have no armed forces whatsoever, and we do not pose a threat neither to Britain or to anybody else because we have nothing to threaten anybody with. Brazil, however, has beefed up its armed forces, and they've bought most of their equipment from Russia. President Medvedev was in Brazil in February of this year and sold Brazil the entire missile defense for the coming World Cup and the coming Olympic Games, and the Americans certainly didn't like that. So in a way, you can reinterpret the Falkland problem not as against Argentina, but as against Brazil, to isolate it on the Atlantic side, because on the Atlantic it will not be able to do much, and there are vast oil reserves off Rio de Janeiro that have been discovered in the past 2 or 3 years. And then on the western side of the American continent, in South America, again, Brazil is isolated because America will always end up having pro-American governments in Mexico, Colombia, Peru, and Chile, because they will put all the money that in necessary to ensure that. So although until early this year, the main country that was being geared or earmarked for Latin American spring treatment was Venezuela because of Hugo Chavez, who was an exceptional leader. Now that he's gone and Mr. Maduro is but a shadow of what Mr. Chavez is, he is much easier to control and to isolate. And so all the Latin American spring focus is definitely on Brazil, because Brazil is the country that they are very much concerned about, because Brazil is potentially very powerful.
Huh. Very interesting. So the corruption in politics and the corporate world is kind of, well, I guess it seems to be sanctioned by the elite in a way. Not only because they gain financially on doing so, but this is what you're talking about. It spawns protests on the street level, which is understandable, of course. But then you have this kind of a class war arising. These protests are used to reform the country in different ways. And at the same time, you can bring in more police, militarized police. You have an excuse, an incentive for bringing in more of a surveillance state, perhaps. So people, Adrian, who are participating in this geopolitical game are falling for the trick. They're falling for a strategy. That's what you're saying in the extension here, right?
Yes, and that's why we're so concerned, and we're trying to really drive that point as much as possible. You see, I take an example, a country like Argentina, which is where I live, but I think that what I'm about to say is practically applicable to almost every other country in the world. It's not that there is corruption in the political system. Corruption is the system.
That's right.
I mean, the whole system is based on corruption. It cannot thrive without corruption. If truly honest politicians were to take over in Britain or in America or in Argentina or in Brazil, the global power elite would be dead because they would not be able to use all their money sloshing to buy politicians, buy local media, and all the things that they do, get the local politicians to indebt their country so that their countries can be indebted for decade after decade after decade, and that is the key instrument of controlling them. So in a way, what they need is for this corruption to keep going on, for them to be able to buy up all the politicians, because rather than for Washington to impose its financial policies on Argentina in a very visible and evident way, it's much better for them to say, hey, no, we'll just arrange for Mr. Kirchner or Mr. Menem or whoever to become president of Argentina, and then they will do our bidding as locals, which is just ideal. And again, the comparison between Argentina and Brazil is very interesting, because the Brazilians are really, really wreaking a lot of havoc in just about every city, amongst other things, because of corruption. And yet, Dilma Rousseff, who is the Brazilian president, she has kicked out 9 key ministers because of corruption allegations in the past 2 years, especially in 2011, where she almost kicked out one minister a month. Her chief of staff, her sports minister, finance minister, defense minister, transportation minister, they were all kicked out. And yet, in spite of that, yet the people still say, yeah, but there's still too much corruption. We don't like that. Let's jump over now to Argentina. We have corruption charges against every minister and every government officer over the past 10 years, and yet the Kirchners have ousted nobody. Yeah. They're all still in power. Hmm. The vice president has tremendous corruption allegations, and yet he still goes to official acts and comes out on television as though nothing happened. Same with Mrs. Kirchner. Same with her transportation minister. Same with her finance minister. So in a way here, it's much, much worse, and yet nothing happens. And I believe that nothing has happened yet because Argentina has not yet been earmarked for Latin American spring treatment. When the powers that be decide that the time has come for Argentina to also bite the dust, it might get terrible here. In a way, what defends us or what protects us is that we are such a weakened country that we don't really pose a threat to them the way Brazil does or the way Venezuela did under Chavez. Because under Chavez, he had such leverage throughout the region that he was a potential danger. In the case of Brazil, they have such industrial leverage. They have a very strong armed forces that if they were to not toe the line, they too could become dangerous. In the case of Argentina, we have very mediocre leadership. The Kirchners have absolutely no ideas, no new ideas. They have no charisma like Mr. Chavez had. And Argentina has no armed forces whatsoever. So all that Argentina does is very joyfully cede all of its huge natural resources to mega corporations on the mining side. I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. The Kirchners last year nationalized, quote unquote, the state oil company, YPF, which had been privatized by the Kirchners themselves 20 years ago to
nice.
Repsol.
Right.
And what they've done now is they've just signed a huge, huge $100 billion contract with Chevron. So as you can see, it's the same people doing things over and over again.
Well, and at the same time, what does it matter if you know they're still under the restriction of government or what to do? I mean, the government and the corporate world is one and the same today. And this is how it's run. This is all rhetoric. It just does, you know, whatever they do to try to please people in a way and make it seem like it's good and all that. But at the end of the day, it's still the same force that generates and kind of runs the show, if you will. So the strategy here is to weaken any country basically that grows strong or has assets or can produce something, has any kind of wealth, you know, to basically rob and make them become dependent on a larger international, you know, banking conglomerate, basically.
Well, that is the key, probably, right now. It might change in the future, but that is the key controlling instrument, just as perhaps in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, the key power leverage were the armed forces of any country. That's why the Soviet Union, in its turn, armed itself to the teeth, America armed itself to the teeth, Germany armed itself to the teeth, and so did Japan. That, in a way, has gone into history's waste bin. They're good at dissuasion, but the real way to run a country is through money, through the whole banking system. Now, that being said, I think it's very interesting to see how they have been able to do this through what I would call probably the mother of all wars. I think that if Saddam Hussein were still around, he would call what I'm about to say the mother of all wars, which is psychological warfare. Because how do they manage this? How do they get away with all these things? Because they have been able to wield through the generations, through a distortion of the educational system, and certainly through the mainstream media, total psychological warfare, so that people will either not understand the real origin of the problem, not see things even though they are smack in front of their noses, and will conduct their thought process and behavior the way that the global power masters want, and even pay for it, because they're paying for these big screen television sets, they're paying for all these electronic gadgets that are the channels through which all this psychological warfare is wielded on each individual mind in every country. So it's good business for them. It gives them fantastic results. And, you know, another thing which I think is very important, and I'd like to very quickly mention, I was giving a conference a couple of months back, well, actually last year, and after the conference, somebody asked, well, what do you think is the global power master's secret weapon? And I said, well, you might think it's a huge military force, but nah, that's control from somewhere else. You would think it's a huge amount of money, and I go, well, yeah, money is good, especially when you can print all you want because you own the Federal Reserve or you own the central banks of every country. Yeah. But if you were to ask me, I think that the real secret weapon that they have is that these people in every country have been educated and nurtured to think long term. So you have a Rockefeller or a Rothschild or a Warburg or a Soros. He knows that he might start a process today that not only will he not see the final result, only his great-grandchildren might see the final result. And they don't have any problem with that because they think really, really long term. Whilst the rest, 99.9% of us, we've been educated and nurtured to think short term. We are told, even if we are in well-to-do families, we've been told, well, you got to get an education, get married, become something important in life, and then when you're 65 or so, you can just sort of relax, play golf, and then game over. You're dead. And yet they know that game over is a biological problem because we all end up dying. But the important thing is that for these very long-term planning actions that take centuries to be carried out, so the fact that we are on the verge of being thrown in or dragged into a world government is a process that probably goes back 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 centuries, and that they have had the capability of that long-term planning by educating their own people to think and act long-term, whilst they keep the rest of us with the world pulled over our eyes, only being able to think very short-term. So we see this process right in front of our noses, but 99.9% of the people don't even identify it as such.
Yeah, you're right. Exactly. This is very very efficient. At the end of it, it's the control of the individual human mind into the collective, if you will, that is the biggest weapon of all. And we are voluntarily giving up that power because ultimately, no matter how much weaponry and money they have at their disposal, if people say no, they cannot defeat everybody. But, you know, so they've realized early on in the process we have to control people's thought process, their mind, and propagandize it, you know, to the full extent to be able to have them follow, you know, following orders, basically. But let's take a short break here before we carry on in the second hour, Adrian. And I wanted to talk a little bit about your websites where people can, you know, go to find out more about your work, where they can kind of follow your writing and see your videos and stuff like that. And also, if you want to, tell us about the Second Republic project.
We have a website called www.secondrepublicproject.com. And my YouTube channel is A.R. Salbucci. That's A.R.S.A.L.B.U.C.H.I. But I must admit that in the last year and a half or so, we've had so much on our hands and we have such little resources to cope with it. In Argentina, probably the main website that we now have and that's really become very activated is the Second Republic in Spanish, Proyecto Segunda República. What I do still hold up both English and Spanish is my own personal website, which is www.asalbucci, that's ASALBUCHI.com.AR. There we have a lot in Spanish and a lot also in English that people can look into. But as I say, we are trying to promote the Second Republic project here in Argentina as a true solution vis-a-vis what the government is proposing and what the government is doing and what the opposition are not proposing, because they have no new ideas. They're merely opposition. You can tell they're just waiting for their turn to be able to have a go at widespread corruption. And the basic idea behind Second Republic, which is being quite successful here, is that rather than try to come up with some really rocket science type solution saying, oh, we have here the perfect solution because we have a team of geniuses and experts that stay up until 5 in the morning thinking things, we just say, look, if you understand how the world power structures really work, if you understand what these people want, who they are, and how they're going about doing it, which is basically what we've just been discussing, Henry, using psychological warfare, using debt as a way of controlling entire countries, buying up politicians and so forth. When you understand how the world really works, which is not what the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Daily Telegraph and Fox News would want you to believe, and you really understand how things work, then you realize that they themselves, the global power elite, have a series of public enemies. Public enemy number one is the truly sovereign nation state. In other words, a nation state that will have as a priority to defend the common good of the majority of the people in each country and to defend the national interest against all the threats coming from abroad. So the truly sovereign nation state is the public enemy number one. Public enemy number two is the use of sovereign currency, in other words, of public money intelligently used instead of private banking money, which really is really truly funny money. And on top of it, they create it out of nothing and they charge you interest for their loans.
Yeah.
The third public enemy is that people started to reject the whole idea of debt, especially public debt, which is what is really making countries like Argentina, Brazil, Italy, Greece, Cyprus, the Netherlands, every country bite the dust. Spain and Italy are definitely next, and Ireland are on the radar screen. So as people started to become aware of the need to reject the whole concept of debt, that concept will be very much public enemy number three. Public enemy number four, we say, is if you can liberate Republican institutions from their dependency on money. We don't have democracy in any country. We merely have a system whereby people who have huge amounts of money will control the political system and the political ideas. So the best you can have is the best. What we have today is the best democracy that money can buy, which is no democracy whatsoever because money is not democratic. And public enemy number five, we say, are all the traditional values that we should never have abandoned and that they've coaxed people into abandoning through the generations. So what Second Republic basically says is, why don't we refound our countries using those public enemies of the global power masters as our reconstruction pillars? In other words, let's reinstate a sovereign nation state, not the colonial entities that our states have been eroded into, but truly sovereign nation states. Let's reinstate sovereign currency. Let's do away with the whole concept of debt as the only way that things can be done on the public or private sphere. Let's truly start implementing political systems that are not dependent on money, so that we do not have the best democracy that money can buy, but a real democracy. And fifth and foremost, let's go back to traditional values. So all you have to do is listen carefully to what your enemy hates and do and wants you to do, and do exactly the opposite.
Right.
And I think that can work, because I'm always reminded of this very beautiful picture of movie that we've all seen, practically, a Gladiator, where what was Maximus' real weapon? he did exactly the opposite of what the emperor wanted him to do. The emperor wanted him to get very angry and go into a rage, and he would merely bow at him and say, no, the time for vengeance is yet to come. So, you know, if psychological warfare is the main mother of all wars that they are using, we have to use our own counter-psychological warfare. And, you know, Hendrik, there are many indications of their weaknesses that we're just not seeing, and if we start to identify them, we can start using them as weapons against them. You were just saying a few minutes ago the way people are, in a way, coaxed and to not understanding many of these things and so forth, and following up on what they want. And yet, for many centuries now, great playwrights like Goethe from Germany have been telling us, for example, in his play Faust, that one of the things that the powerful, the dark powers need is your willingness, your free will to follow them.
That's right.
You know, you have to actually sign a contract, and they keep harping on that, even in Hollywood movies, and people are not saying that.
Yeah, you're right. It's a very good point. Aselbucci.com.ar, we're going to have that linked up, and then also secondrepublicproject.com is one of the websites. We're going to have that linked up again. And what was the Spanish version of that website as well, so you can give that out again?
Yes, it's a proyecto, that's proyecto, segunda, segunda, república, proyecto segunda república. It's rather long, but it's basically Second Republic Project in Spanish, proyecto segunda república.
I'm going to do my best to link that up as well.
No. I'll put it on Skype for you.
Oh, thank you. Really good. Yeah, no, we'll find it. No worries. I'm just making a joke here. All right, well, stay with us, Adrian. We'll be right back with more, and we'll proceed then. Much more to talk about. Okay, and as we continue in the second hour with Adrian Salbucci, we will discuss the Arab Spring and various demonstrations and rallies around the world. And Adrian gives us his somewhat unique perspective on these stunts. We'll also discuss what is going on in Venezuela after Hugo Chavez died. We talk about how the economy is being dismantled intentionally as a means to reform the system and get us further dependent on a debt-based centralized governmental system. Adrian gives us a few pointers on how to remain autonomous under these conditions. Don't miss the second hour. A very interesting discussion continues. RedIceMembers.com is where to go to acquire a membership and continue to listen to our second hour and all of our previous interviews. We have over 700 programs on many different topics. Take a look and join us when you want to hear more and support our broadcast. We'll return in just a few days with Graham Hancock on his historical novel, War God. Then we have Ken Rolla on Ormesite and Scalar technologies used for healing and free energy. Later, Scott Onstott, Suzanne Posel, David Icke, and others are coming on. Again, go to redicemembers.com for the full broadcast. We'll see you there. Thanks for listening.